Several months ago, back in July, I started into a series in Bible study called Wokeism. And I only did a couple of installments in that, and then I had to postpone Bible studies for a while. And I have decided to get back to that study now as a sermon series instead of a Bible study series. And I'm just going to briefly review, very briefly, what I covered back then, because you probably might not remember. But I did talk about, at the time, I defined wokeism, first of all, what it is, and then gave five ideologies, this is the way that I would characterize it anyway, that make up wokeism. And those ideologies are social justice, critical race theory, gender identity, diversity, equity, inclusion, which goes by the acronym DEI. It used to be DIE, which was much more apropos, but then they changed it around to DEI to not give it such a negative connotation of die, right? I believe in die. So anyway, and then environmental, social, and corporate governance, which is the acronym ESG. So back in July and August, I only covered social justice, and without going through everything, basically I defined what social justice is and showed that it's essentially a synonym of socialism, or it could be properly termed social injustice because it is anything but just. And we talked about how the Bible indeed does command the fair treatment of all people, which is what social justice portends to advance, which of course they don't. And then we talked about the whole idea of making everybody equal and equitable and redistributing the wealth so that everybody has an equal share, which is what this whole idea comes down to. Like I said, it's socialism rebranded. And then I talked about various things about how the Bible teaches that, you know, it's the person who owns the resources, it's up to them, how they distribute their own resources, and that God has ordained that there's always going to be poor people on this earth, so that the idea of making everybody equal is just an assault against God, because that's not going to happen. And we talked about various other things related to that, and you can go back and listen to those sermons. I recommend that you do. I listened to them this past week or so, and it's amazing how much I forgot that I myself said several months ago. So I'd recommend reviewing them if you are so inclined. So today what I want to do, and next Sunday, is talk about critical race theory. And some of you are probably going to find this interesting. I mean, this whole series, and this one in particular, some of you will probably find it boring. Some of you may not even want to hear it at all, based on some of the things that you're going to hear. And the kind of garbage that's happening in the public school systems and so on. But I think it is necessary to talk about this, to cover this, because this is a major thing, whether you're even aware of it or not. I mean, you may have heard these terms, but this is a major thing. I'm trying to think of the word I was looking for, a major movement happening in this country. And it is seeking to completely overthrow and redefine our entire society. So it's a very serious thing. It really is. So, like I said, next two Sundays I want to talk about critical race theory. And I'm going to do a lot of reading for the first part of this sermon. And the reason I'm going to do this is because if I just told you what this is, you might not believe me. And if I told you how bad it is, and the things that these people teach in advance, and what they're promoting in the public school systems, at least in some of them. Hopefully it hasn't gotten here yet, but it won't surprise me if it does, because things generally tend to move from the east and the west to the center of the country. As goes California, so goes the nation, as they say. So anyway, I want to read these things to you, because otherwise you'd say, oh, he's just exaggerating. I'm not exaggerating. So let me just define critical race theory for you. They love to use these words that just on the face of them, you'd have no idea what it's even talking about. Because that way, you know, kind of keeps people in the dark about what they're really talking about. If they called it, like, you know, the theory of reverse racism or something, then people would be like, that doesn't sound right to me or whatever. So anyway, Critical race theory, this is according to Merriam-Webster.com, a group of concepts such as the idea that race is a sociological rather than biological designation, and that racism pervades society and is fostered and perpetuated by the legal system. Okay, so that was a parenthetical clause there describing these concepts. So let me read it without the parenthetical clause, so it's a little easier to get the whole thing here. A group of concepts used for examining the relationship between race and the laws and legal institutions of a country, and especially the United States. And so just by the definition, you can see there that these people have an ideology that teaches that racism pervades society and is fostered and perpetuated by the legal system. So these people think that this country is just through and through racist. White people are. Nobody else is. But white people are through and through racists. Okay? And they're not referring back to the days of the Jim Crow laws. They're talking about today, when racism has all but been obliterated, had been until they brought it back. They're talking about, like, the society we live in today. And they would have you to believe that racism is systemic across the whole system. And it's just, we're all a bunch of racists, even if you don't realize it. Even if you don't think you are. If you don't think you're a racist, you're definitely a racist. If you say you're not a racist, well, you are most definitely a racist. Because if somebody asks you, are you a racist, and you say no, that's exactly what a racist says, right? So you can't really argue with these kind of people. Here's from Wikipedia. This is their article on critical race theory. They say critical race theory, CRT, is a cross-disciplinary examination by social and civil rights scholars and activists of how laws, social and political movements, and media shape and are shaped by social conceptions of race and ethnicity. The word critical in the name is an academic reference to critical thinking, critical theory, and scholarly criticism rather than criticizing or blaming people. CRT is also used in sociology to explain social, political, and legal structures and power distribution through a lens focusing on the concept of race and experiences of racism. For example, the CRT conceptual framework examines racial bias in laws and legal institutions such as highly disparate rates of incarceration among racial groups in the United States. A key CRT concept is intersectionality, the way in which different forms of inequality and identity are affected by interconnections of race, class, gender, and disability. Scholars of CRT view race as a social construct with no biological basis. One tenet of CRT is that racism and disparate racial outcomes are the result of complex, changing, and often subtle social and institutional dynamics rather than explicit and intentional prejudices of individuals. Well, we're not saying that each individual is prejudiced, and you wouldn't even know if you are, because you're just part of this big system, and it's a systematic thing. And so they try to, you know, gaslight you into believing that you're a racist when you know you're not, but you actually are, because it's the system that you live in, and you're just so inoculated in it, you don't even realize that you're such a racist. Kind of hard to argue against something like that. CRT scholars argue that social and legal construction of race advances the interest of white people at the expense of people of color, and that the liberal notion of U.S. law as neutral plays a significant role in maintaining a racially unjust social order where formally colorblind laws continue to have racially discriminatory outcomes. It could also be that just certain types of people commit more crimes than other types of people, and they end up in prison more than other types of people, right? I mean, that could be an answer, too. And it could have to do with how those types of people were raised, possibly, and it could have to do with the welfare system that has enslaved certain types of people in a system where they're brought up with one-parent households and the father's not around and they end up in gangs. Maybe that could explain some of it, too. Possibly. The article continues. Scholars of CRT say that race is not biologically grounded and natural. Rather, it is socially constructed. It is a socially constructed category used to oppress and exploit people of color, and that racism is not an aberration, but a normalized feature of American society. According to CRT, negative stereotypes assigned to members of minority groups benefit white people and increase racial oppression. So it's all about white people have created this racism, this society of racism to benefit white people and to keep other people down. That's what this whole thing boils down to. And what's irritating about it to me is that CRT advocates are trying to undo the progress of the last 60 years and to recreate a racist society. That's really what they're trying to do. Over the last 60 years, tremendous progress has been made in this country to eradicate racism. To the point when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, now granted, I grew up in a very rural community, but in some places that's where they would say that racism is pervasive the most, in these rural backwoods Hicks communities or whatever. I didn't grow up racist. I mean, we only had, I think, like one little black kid in our school or something, because, you know, there wasn't a lot of diversity there. But there was no racism against him. There was people didn't talk like that. The only bit of racism that I would say that I grew up with at all would be people that didn't think that blacks and whites should intermarry for the sake of children, because the children are not going to feel like they fit in either one. That was the argument. And I bought into that when I was a kid. But I've long since dispensed that. That would be it. I mean, there was no racism when I grew up. As a matter of fact, the funny thing is, when I was growing up, when I was a kid, I thought, because I knew about racism, I just didn't really experience it. I didn't have prejudice against blacks or anybody else. But I thought that racism was a thing where only white people were racist against blacks. I thought that was the extent of racism. I didn't realize that there's been racism across the entire world. I mean, different Asian countries and Asian ethnicities hate each other, right? It's not just whites and blacks. This has been throughout human history, for one thing. But for two, it wasn't until I got into the army that I realized that it's not just among people that are racist, it's not just whites that are racist against blacks. It's blacks that are racist against whites. And I was blown away by this. I had no idea until I got there, and I realized, boy, these black people hate white. Some of these black people don't like white people. And I was just shocked. Like, I didn't know it went both ways. But it does. But even then, things had come a long, long way to the point where I would say, at least in my experience in this country, up until recent years, like, racism was a thing of the past. Like, I didn't see racism when it came to how people viewed black people or hiring them or working with them or marrying them or anything else. I didn't see any of that. But what they're doing is they're trying to bring all that back. They're trying to create a racially divisive society. And it's really irritating. They're fomenting racism, not reducing it. And you just think about the whole Black Lives Matter thing, which I'll read something from them here in a minute, but they're fomenting this whole thing, like with when that black kid got killed down there in Florida because he attacked it was a Latino guy, actually, and the Latino guy killed him. Trayvon Martin was the kid that got killed, and the other guy, I forget his name. Anyway, and they stoked up a race war over that whole thing, and they suppressed the truth. And as it turned out, that guy was attacked by that teenage boy. And was like having his head smashed against the pavement, and in self-defense pulled out his gun and shot the kid when he's on top of him. Like, I mean, you can see pictures of him. He's like covered in blood. That is the not the black kid, the other guy. And so anyway, but they stoked up a race war over that whole thing. And they did it intentionally. That wasn't by accident. I mean, they do this stuff intentionally. They are trying to divide the nation. That's really irritating. I hate that. Let me just give you some examples of CRT being promoted in public and private schools. If I didn't read this stuff to you, like I said, you might not believe it. This is from the School District of Philadelphia. And this is the School District of Philadelphia's Anti-Racist Declaration. And you can find it on their website. I have links to all this stuff in the outline. While we believe in and will continue to cultivate a system that addresses all forms of inequity, because of both historical and current events within our nation and city, it is imperative that we take a laser focus on acknowledging and dismantling systems of racial inequality. For us, this goes deeper and far beyond focusing on individual acts of prejudice and discrimination, but refers to uprooting policies, deconstructing processes, and eradicating practices that create systems of privilege and power for one racial group over another. I want you to notice four words there that they used in this thing: dismantling, uprooting, deconstructing, and eradicating. What they really want to do is dismantle, uproot, deconstruct, and eradicate Western civilization. That's what these people are really up to. The whole racism thing is just their excuse and their pretext for doing that. They want to uproot our very society, our Christian, I mean, it really comes down to uprooting Christian society as well. Notice they're not talking about just, you know, maybe you have an individual, maybe there's a few people out there left that are actually racist. You know, I'm sure that there are a few people in this country that are actually racist. You could probably find them. But they're not looking to just try to correct the thinking of those few people. Oh no, they want to burn the whole system down, right, and start over again. These people are communists, is what they are. And I'll read it to you. You'll see here, when I read from Black Lives Matter, you'll see these people are communists. They want to completely destroy and remake Western civilization. I continue here from this article. Some may ask, why are we not talking about racism when there are other systems of oppression that need to be addressed? To that I will answer, race is a social construction that set the foundation and built the infrastructure. Race is the social construction that set the foundation and built the infrastructure of the United States we know today. Did you see what she said there? Race is the social construction that set the foundation and built the infrastructure for the United States we know today. Race. Not free market capitalism, not the Protestant work ethic, right? Not freedom and liberty and private property and free enterprise, right? Not that. No. Race. Race. The system, the society that we have today was built on the foundation of race, they tell us. I mean, how absurd is that? Totally absurd. Racism is the root of all other forms of injustice and provides the nourishment needed for other systems of oppression to thrive. As such, in order to destroy the tree, we cannot simply pick at the leaves or chop away at the trunk. We must destroy the root. That's what I'm saying. They want to destroy the very foundation of this country and of Western civilization itself. And this is the kind of garbage that is being taught in public schools in the school district of Philadelphia. It's not just Philadelphia. Here's from Buffalo. Buffalo School District's new fifth grade curriculum centered on Black Lives Matter. This is from a statement here from the Office of Culturally and Linguistically Responsive Initiatives. Now, let me tell you what. If you hear any statement coming from any office called the Office of Culturally and Linguistically Responsive Initiatives, you know it's going to be garbage without even reading it. This is their fifth grade Black Lives Matter Intergenerational Black Families and Black Villages, July 2020. And I have the URL there. You can read it for yourself. Here's what they say. This is they're giving instruction to the teachers on the curriculum that they're going to teach these fifth graders. Fifth graders. What grade's Braden in? Fourth. Okay. So basically Braden's age. Next year, right? This is the kind of garbage that they would be teaching to Braden next year if you lived in Buffalo. Which Buffalo is not exactly San Francisco or Los Angeles or Portland or one of the ultra-liberal places even. They say, discuss these principles and have students talk about how they connect to them. Black Villages is the disruption of Western nuclear family dynamics and a return to the, quote, collective village, unquote, that takes care of each other. Did you notice that? Black Villages is the disruption of Western nuclear family dynamics. You know what the nuclear family is? That's the basic family unit, father, mother, and children, right? It is the backbone of society, of all societies, especially of Western society. It is the absolute backbone. And what does this Black Villages thing want to do? The disruption of Western nuclear family dynamics. They're saying the quiet part out loud. Like, they're saying the part you're not supposed to tell everybody what you're doing. Like, you're supposed to keep that secret. They're saying it out loud. The article continues, or the statement continues, Black Lives Matter Declaration on Black Villages. So this is the heading. We are committed to disrupting the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and, quote, villages, unquote, that collectively care for one another and especially, quote, our, unquote, children to the degree, now listen to this, of course they have to throw this in there, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. We want to destroy and root out your family, your whole family structure, as long as you guys are comfortable with it, right? If your parents and children, if you're all comfortable with your whole family just being blown apart and being raised by the state, then, you know, we want to go ahead with this. But if you're not comfortable with it, don't worry about it. Yeah, right. Like they care what you're comfortable with. And you notice, did you notice? Somebody conspicuously missing there to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. Fathers. Notice that fathers, I mean, I guess they're included in parents, maybe, right? But notice how it's mothers, parents, children. Fathers aren't even included in this. Like, fathers are just, they don't want fathers involved because, you know, the father's actually like the head of the house, right? The backbone, the strength of the family, right? These people are evil. Evil. Anybody that wants to, what was the word? Disrupt the nuclear family is an evil person. Now, this quote echoes a statement on the Black Lives Matter website before they removed it. Okay? Now, this used to be on the Black Lives Matter website, blacklivesmatter.com/whatwebelieve. They've taken it down for obvious reasons because it's so heinous and evil that they themselves couldn't keep it up there because it would cause them to blush, probably. But you can find it on webarchive.org. There are a couple of different sites out there that archive every page on the internet. And even if somebody takes it down, you can go to web.archive.org and then you can find that page and you can look, go back in time and you can see a website and you can see what the pages used to look like and what, you know, what they look like now. So you can go, I got the article, or I got the link here, which you can go back and look at what Black Lives Matter website used to say before they got enough public scrutiny that they took it down. Quote, we disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement by supporting each other as extended families and, quote, villages, unquote, that collectively care for one another, especially our children, to the degree that mothers, parents, and children are comfortable. Basically exactly what the Buffalo curriculum thing said. They took it right from Black Lives Matter. Okay? We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure. Collectively care for each other. Right? These people are communists. This is flat out communism. That's what Karl Marx wanted to do. Destroy the nuclear family unit and have the children raised by the state. Have them raised by the village. This is straight up communism. Here are some other things that the Black Lives Matter site said before they removed it. Quote, we make space for transgender brothers and sisters to participate and lead, unquote. Here's another one. We are self-reflexive and do the work required to dismantle cisgender privilege. Now, I'll get to what cisgender means when we get to the gender identity. You may not be familiar with that term. Cisgender is a synonym for normal, okay? if you are cisgender, that means you're normal. That means that you think you are the gender that you actually are, and you act like the gender you actually are. Right? That's what cisgender means. We have to, these days, we have to have a term for people who are normal, where we didn't used to have a term for them at all. They were just called people. Or, you know, you didn't even have to refer to them as anything. Now you have to refer to them as cisgender, just to let everybody know that this is a normal person. Right? We are self-reflexive and do the work required to dismantle cisgender privilege and uplift black trans folk, especially black trans women, who continue to be disproportionately impacted by trans antagonistic violence. Now, let me explain again. Black trans women. You would think that this is referring to women who are trans. No, this is referring to men who think they are women. So when you hear about a trans woman, and I'll get into this, like I said, I'll get into this later, but when you hear about a trans woman, it's not a woman, it's a man who thinks he's a woman. If you hear about a trans man, it's not a man, it's a woman who thinks she's a man. They use this confusing terminology, and I think on purpose. So, you know, these people, I mean, these are bedfellows. The trans, all the weirdos, the sodomites, right, and Black Lives Matter, these communist organizations, they're all bedfellows. Here's another quote for you. We foster a queer-affirming network. When we gather, we do so with the intention of freeing ourselves from the tight grip of heteronormative thinking. Heteronormative being interpreted means normal, okay? Or rather, the belief that all in the world are heterosexual unless she or he or they disclose otherwise. Like I said, normal. Assuming that people that you meet are heterosexual unless you're told otherwise, right? That's heteronormative, or just normal thinking, in other words. So, if you were under the misunderstanding that Black Lives Matter was an organization that was set up to help black people that are downtrodden, that have been you know, mistreated or oppressed, and they're just trying to help out black people, you were sorely mistaken. This is a communist, Marxist, wicked organization that wants to dismantle the Western prescribed nuclear family. This is not about helping black people that are down. This is about destroying Western civilization. Race is just the pretext. That's it. All right, now it's not only public schools. The private schools are involved in this stuff too. And it seems like probably the better the one you go to, the worse it's going to be. Here's a school called the Shipley School. This is a school in Pennsylvania. So we got two here in my home state. We got two of these schools that are promoting this wickedness. The Shipley School is a private school in Pennsylvania, which cost over $40,000 per year for middle school tuition and over $44,000 per year for high school tuition. That's like what Harvard and Yale used to cost. I don't know what they cost now. They probably cost a lot more than that. That's, if you sent a child to the Shipley School from 6th to 12th grade, you would have spent $296,000 on their, quote, education. I put that in quotes because you'll see here that they're not getting much of an education, just from what one of their middle school teachers has to say. That's per child. If you had a couple of children, $600,000 for their middle school and high school education. There's an old proverb, not a biblical one, but there's an old proverb that says, a fool and his money are soon parted. Yeah, right there's a good example. Lila Corgan, a middle school English teacher and the middle school diversity, equity, and inclusion coordinator at the Shipley School, wrote a blog on decentering, quote, on a blog on, this is the title, Decentering Whiteness at Home and in Your Family on the Shipley School website. The blog post was later removed, but a copy of it can still be found at web.archive.org. They don't like to keep their own stuff up there when people start actually reading it and realizing what they're about. Here's what this lady had to say. She said, as the parent of three children, ages 8, 7, and 3, I've been thinking a lot about how our family is dominated by and or perpetuates the values of white culture. Now, this is, as I remember, this is a white woman, okay? So she's been thinking a lot about these things. This is kind of troubling to her. And how I might replace our center with multiracial values. This is what you call virtue signaling. By saying that whiteness is, quote, at the center, unquote, of American society is to say that access to power, control of resources, and the ability to enforce cultural values and policies disproportionately belongs to white people. I feel bad for people that are self-loathing, that just hate themselves because they've been told by the media and the powers that be that you have to hate yourself. If you're white, you gotta hate yourself. You gotta sit there and, you know, thrash and flog yourself just because you happen to be white, and that's such a terrible thing. I really feel bad for people like that. She continues here, be deliberate about language. Pay attention to how your language may perpetuate, quote, universal, unquote, standards of beauty, speech, behavior, dress, conflict resolution, etc. It's quite common for a person to compliment two of my three children on their beautiful blue eyes. While I always appreciate the compliment, I am conscious of my third brown-eyed child. What message is she receiving about how she fits in with the European standards of beauty? When in my own positive and negative interactions with children have I come from a white-centered approach? Now, wouldn't you just love having this woman teaching your middle school children? But this kind of CRT garbage ends up poisoning the minds of people to now she's thinking, why don't I raise my family like we're, you know, multiracial or something when we're not? How about you just raise your family like the way you were raised? Like, just be a normal person, right? Just, what's wrong with that, right? If other ethnicities want to raise their families in different ways, then let them raise their families how they want. Why don't you just raise yours the way you want it? I mean, what is with this? It's crazy. Like I said, they're just creating the problem. There's no problem. There's no problem. They're just creating a problem. It's just ridiculous. But it gets beyond ridiculous. We're going now from the sublime to the ridiculous, I guess you'd say. This is from the Oregon Department of Education. Now, if the other ones didn't surprise you, this one might. In February 2021, the Oregon Department of Education promoted something called, quote, a pathway to math equity microcourse, which was offered by a pathway to equitable math instruction organization. So I'm going to read here from the equitablemath.org website about this program. And here's what they have to say about the program. Quote, a pathway to equitable math instruction is an integrated approach to mathematics that centers on Black Latinx, which, by the way, is a word they just made up, Latinx. It refers to Latinos, but Latinx, they just make up words. Black Latinx and multilingual students in grades 6 through 8. Addresses barriers to math equity and aligns instruction to grade level priority standards. The pathway offers guidance and resources for educators to use now as they plan their curriculum, while also offering opportunities for ongoing self-reflection as they seek to develop an anti-racist math practice. Did you know that? Racism is being promoted through math. You know that? Did you realize that when you went to, you know, back when we all went to school, did you realize that when we took arithmetic and algebra and geometry, we were being taught to be white supremacists? Did you realize that? Oh, yeah. The toolkit, quote, strides. They have these different strides, which are, you'll see what it is here in a minute. The toolkit strides serve as multiple on-ramps for educators as they navigate the individual and collective journey from equity to anti-racism. This is not a sociology course. This is not an anthropology course. This is not a history course. This is mathematics. We need to disable racism and white supremacy in mathematics, of all things. Now you're thinking, how in the world would mathematics have anything to do with racism? But they'll explain it to you here. So the program is comprised of five strides on the path to math equity. So here are the quotes from stride one, dismantling racism in mathematics instruction. Quote, this tool provides teachers an opportunity to examine their actions, beliefs, and values around teaching mathematics. The framework for deconstructing racism in mathematics offers essential characteristics of anti-racist math educators and critical approaches to dismantling white supremacy in math classrooms by making visible the toxic characteristics of white supremacy culture. White supremacy culture in a math classroom. You can't make this stuff up. That's why I said I had to read it to you. If I had told you this, you'd have said, you know what, Pastor, I know you're an honest guy, but you are given to exaggeration. There's just no way this could possibly be true. That's why I'm reading it to you. The toxic characteristics of white supremacy culture with respect to math. Building on the framework, teachers engage with critical praxis in order to shift their instructional beliefs and practices toward anti-racist math education. By centering anti-racism, we model how to be anti-racist math educators with accountability. I'm going to continue here in this reading about this program. Now you say, well, this is Oregon. This isn't Missouri. Not yet. No, maybe Missouri will never go this way. But you know, they're already, you know, the Excelsior School District is now contemplating a 4-day school week. And of course it's because they need to be able to attract teachers, and other school districts are going to a 4-day week. So in order to attract teachers, you know, if you can work 5 days or 4 days, everybody's going to pick 4 days. So we got to go 4 days, right? I don't suppose it has anything to do with the fact that the teachers want a day off and only want to work 4 days a week, right? That probably has nothing to do with it. Anyway, I continue. White supremacy culture infiltrates math classrooms and everyday teacher actions. White supremacy culture in math classrooms. Coupled with the beliefs that underlie these actions, they perpetuate educational harm on Black, Latinx, and multilingual students, denying them full access to the world of mathematics. The table below identifies the ways in which white supremacy shows up in math classrooms. And now we're going to give a bunch of them, and then we're going to go through each one of them. Dismantling white supremacy culture in math classrooms. We see white supremacy culture show up in the mathematics classroom even as we carry out our professional responsibilities outlined in the California Standards for the Teaching Profession, CSTP. Using CSTP as a framework, we see white supremacy culture in the mathematics classroom can show up when. And now here's when it can show up. It's just lurking behind, you know, every desk in the classroom. The quote, there is a greater focus on getting the quote right unquote answer than understanding concepts and reasoning. Yes. If you emphasize getting the right answer to a math problem, you, my friend, are a white supremacist. They put right in quotes. Like I said, this is not sociology. This is not history. This is not the social sciences, which are up for debate and interpretation and are subjective, right? There's nothing subjective about math. That's one thing that I really like about it, is that there is one right answer to every problem, period. Now, there may be different ways of going about to get it, but there is one right answer in math. But if you say that, you are a white supremacist. The next thing, how white supremacy culture in mathematics can show up, is when independent practice is valued over teamwork or collaboration. Now let me ask you a question. If when you were in school and you did your math problems by teamwork, and you're in a group, what do you suppose is going to happen? The smart kid that knows how to do math is going to do all the work, and you're not going to learn a thing, because you're going to be lazy and not be forced to do it, right? Yeah, teamwork in math is a wonderful idea. But then again, what else would a white supremacist say? Here's another way that white supremacy can show up in math classrooms. Contrived word problems that are valued over the math in students' lived experiences. Students are tracked into courses, pathways, and within the classroom. And participation structures reinforce dominant ways of being. Now, they will explain what they mean by that nonsense as well here in a minute. All right, so now they're going to go through each of these things and explain them for us. White supremacy culture shows up in math classrooms when there is a greater focus on getting the right answer than understanding concepts and reasoning. Upholding the idea that there are always right and wrong answers perpetuate objectivity as well as fear of open conflict. Can you believe what you're reading? Upholding the idea that there are always right and wrong answers. And we're talking about math here, right? This perpetuates objectivity, what an evil thing, as well as fear of open conflict. Because the child, if the teacher says, Billy, 2 + 2 = 4, if the child's not free to say, but teacher, I think 2 + 2 = 5, the poor guy is going to fear the open conflict. And that would, I mean, that's white supremacy by definition. Some math problems may have more than one right answer, and some may not have a solution at all, depending on the content and the context. I have a feeling that the person that wrote this, probably most of the math problems that he would try to work out probably don't have a solution in his own mind because he can't figure them out because he's not all that bright, obviously. And when the focus is only on getting the right answer, the complexity of the mathematical concepts and reasoning may be underdeveloped, missing opportunities for deep learning. All right, now on to the next one. White supremacy culture shows up in math classrooms when independent practice is valued over teamwork or collaboration. Quote, while there is some value in students being able to complete work independently, there is some value in students being able to complete math problems on their own. Just some. Because, you know, when you go out in the real world and you're walking through the grocery store and you're trying to compute that, you know, how many dollars per ounce this thing costs by how many dollars per ounce this costs and see which is the best deal, more than likely you're going to huddle together with a group of people there and try to figure this out collectively, right? There's just a little bit of blessing that might come about by being able to do a math problem on your own. Just a little bit. I was really going to not be sarcastic in this sermon at all and just keep it straight to the facts, but I just am failing miserably at that. I'll start that sentence over again. While there is some value in students being able to complete work independently, when this is the only or most common avenue for learning or practicing, it reinforces individualism. See, these people are communists. They hate the idea of individualism. It reinforces individualism and the notion that I'm the only one. Did you all turn into narcissists when you took math class and you had to complete the problems yourself and realized, I'm the only one because I added these two numbers up and got the right answer? This does not give value to collectivism. See, like I said, these people are communists. This does not give value to collectivism and community understanding and fosters conditions for competition and individual success. That's a horrible thing, isn't it? To have competition and individual success in math class. The only person that would be an advocate of something evil like that, of individual success and competition, would be a white supremacist. That's the only person that would think that's a good idea. And fosters conditions for competition and individual success, which perpetuates the idea that if a student is failing, it is because they are not trying hard enough or that they don't care. Those two things aren't connected anyway. individual success and competition does not therefore infer that somebody who's not doing well is not trying hard enough or something. Maybe it just is they need it explained in a different way or something like that. But anyway. All right, the next one. White supremacy culture shows up in math classrooms when contrived word problems are valued over the math in students' lived experiences. Quote, often the emphasis is placed on learning math in the real world. That's in quotes. As if our classrooms are not part of the real world. Let me burst your bubble. Your classrooms are not part of the real world. Especially these classrooms. But classrooms in general are not part of the real world. When have you in the real world in your actual life ever had an experience like you were in high school? It's not the real world. That is not how the real world works. It's a artificially generated thing. And it's not the way that education was always done either. It's the Prussian model that was founded here a few hundred years ago. The public school model that we have where you go to a class, you sit there for 45 minutes, the bell rings, you go to the next class, you're with all the students of the exact same age. This is not how education was ever done in the past up until relatively recently. Even when my dad was a kid, that's not the way that education was done. My dad's old enough that he went to a one-room schoolhouse for the first couple of years. That's how education used to be done, or it was done at home. A lot of the founding fathers were homeschooled also. But the classrooms today are not the real world. Not at all. That's why I think these poor kids have so much trouble, depression, anxiety, because they're not living in a real world. They are stuck in this constructed system where they spend 8 hours a day with kids their exact same age the whole time, whereas in ages past, they would have either been at a one-room schoolhouse with a bunch of kids of different ages where the older ones help the younger ones and there's a teacher and there's order and that kind of thing. And then when they did the one-room schoolhouse, they would go until eighth grade like my grandparents did, and then they would graduate and go out and work on the farm or get a job or whatever, and they would be working with adults. So you'd have a 14-year-old boy graduated from school, and he'd be working with an adult man or men learning how to be a man for the next several years as he's a teenager. Instead of, in his teenage years, being stuck with a bunch of other teenagers his own age, which are all going to be bad influences on him. You know what happens when you get a bunch of teenagers together, right? You've all been one, right? So in the past, that's not how things worked. And it worked a lot better in the past. But anyway, that's a bit of a soapbox. Often the emphasis is placed on learning math in the real world as if our classrooms are not part of the real world. This reinforces notions of either-or thinking because math is only seen as useful when it is in a particular context. However, this can result in using mathematics to uphold capitalist and imperialist ways of being and understandings of the world. I told you, these people are communists. They hate capitalism. All right, the next one. White supremacy culture shows up in math classrooms when participation structures reinforce dominant ways of being. Now, let's hear what they have to say about this. Classrooms are often microcosms of the world around us and reinforce dominant or white ways of being. For example, small groups of students receive the teacher's attention throughout instruction, and a few students are typically called on to participate in class discussions, reinforcing notions of perfectionism. The patterns of students who fall into these categories often mirror societal norms. Another common participation structure is pairing students as helper and helpee. This reinforces paternalism. And other power structures that identify students as either being good or bad at math, also either-or thinking. Also, requiring students to raise their hand before speaking can reinforce paternalism and power hoarding. Don't you love the stupid terms that these lefties come up with? Can reinforce paternalism and power hoarding in addition to breaking the process of learning, of thinking, learning, and communicating. Yes, because it would be a much better system for any child to be able to blurt out anything he wants at any time without raising his hand and getting the attention of the teacher so that everybody can hear what he has to say, right? Because, you know, in the real world, you can just, in a meeting, you can just blurt out anything you want anytime. In the real world, in church, when I'm up here preaching, I mean, you guys can just blurt out whatever you want at any moment, right? That's how it works in the real world, right? You're at a company meeting and the CEO is going over some reports about how the company did it. And you can just blurt out anything, right? Interrupt him right in the middle of it. That's how the real world works, right? The next one. White supremacy culture shows up in math classrooms when control of classrooms is valued over students' agency over their learning. Students' agency over their learning. The students get to determine what they're going to learn. The students need to be in control. As for my people, women rule over them and children are their oppressors. They that lead thee cause thee to err, the Lord said. Isaiah 3 and verse 12, I think it is. Unique to mathematics is the idea that new learning comes from the teacher. Unique to mathematics is the idea that new learning comes from the teacher. These people are totally insane. Number one, that is not unique to mathematics. That's pretty much how every subject works, right? If you're being taught by a teacher, that is, new learning comes from the teacher, right? When's the last time new learning came from the student? You show up to school and then you, what, tell the teacher what it is that you're going to learn? Or this is ridiculous. It's absurd. Even when learning is connected to previous knowledge and experiences, the idea is often that teachers provide the learning and are in charge of disseminating new information. This reinforces the ideas of paternalism and power hoarding. When students bring a different approach to doing math, teachers often get defensive and see it as a challenge to the power structures in the classroom. And I've witnessed some of this idea. When I worked at Mathnasium back 10 years ago, the first year I was in the ministry, Mathnasium did things right. We taught math the traditional way. Now, they had some really interesting way of explaining things. I think they had a great program there. But we taught like multiplication and division the traditional, normal way. And you probably don't even know what I'm referring to when I say the traditional, normal way, you wouldn't know that there's another way. So the way that you grew up doing multiplication and division, that's the traditional, normal way, okay? But now they teach these other convoluted, weird ways of doing multiplication and division. Some of you parents may be aware of it if they're teaching this nonsense in our schools. And the kids would come to us with these convoluted ways of doing it, and we would have to understand that way and show them how they had to do it on a test, maybe, because that's the way the teacher wanted to see it. But then we would teach them the right way, the traditional way that's been done for thousands of years, or at least hundreds. And so this is the kind of novel nonsense that they come up with. They can't leave well enough alone. Like I said, this is not a class on technology or computer programming or medicine or something that evolves and changes. It's math. It never changes, right? So there's no reason, probably, to go back and change the way math has been taught for hundreds and thousands of years because people figured it out over time, right? But anyway. So when a student brings up a different approach, the teacher gets upset about this because the teacher's a power hoarder, right? All right, I continue here. White supremacy culture shows up in math classrooms when good, quote, good math teaching is considered an antidote for mathematical inequity for Black, Latinx, multilingual students. I don't even know what that means. Best practices, quote, unquote, for math pedagogy often exclude the unique needs of Black, Latinx, and multilingual or migrant students. What kind of needs do Black, Latinx, and multilingual or migrant students have when it comes to teaching them arithmetic, multiplication, division, algebra? What kind of special needs do they have? I mean, think about this. This is ridiculous. Unique needs. I mean, everybody does math the same. It's like math's a universal language. What unique needs do you need? I would like to know. This reinforces either-or thinking by reinforcing stereotypes about the type of mathematical education that certain groups of students receive. It allows the defensiveness of Western mathematics to prevail without addressing underlying causes of why certain groups of students are, quote, underperforming, unquote, a characterization that should also be interrogated. It also presupposes that, quote, good, unquote, math teaching is about a Eurocentric type of mathematics devoid of cultural ways of being. The next one, white supremacy culture shows up in math classrooms when grading practices center on what students don't understand rather than what they do understand. Grades are traditionally indicative of what students can't do rather than what they can do, reinforcing perfectionism, which I would not agree with that. When you got, at least when I was in school, we were graded with percentages, right? And then those percentages equated to an A or a B or whatever. But if you got a 90% on a test, that means you got 90% of the questions right, right? So your grade is showing how much you know, not how much you don't know. They didn't give you the grade on the test and say you got a 10%, meaning you got 10% wrong, right? So I don't even know what they're talking about here. But why would I even waste 3 seconds trying to understand what these people are talking about? In addition, math teachers also focus grades on what is more easily measurable rather than the knowledge that we want students to have, reinforcing quantity over quality, and often evaluating procedural or skills-based knowledge rather than conceptual knowledge. All right, so if you didn't think that somehow CRT could infect even things like math, you were wrong, right? Even something that would be as far from touching on race as possible, something like math, even that they have infiltrated and are promoting this wicked communist agenda in the math classroom. And then here's one more for you. This is from Richfield High School in Minnesota. This is a quote from an article in Alpha News. The article is called "School Staff Meeting Begins by Committing to Dismantling Whiteness." This is from 2021. Quote, "Teachers and staff at Richfield High School apparently begin all their meetings by committing to dismantling, quote, processes that benefit whiteness." That's according to Principal Stacy Thean Collins, who spoke to the school board at a Monday meeting. This doesn't surprise me coming out of Minnesota. They are ultra-liberal and progressive up there, sadly. Quote, we're going to start like we start all our high school meetings, which is with our Richfield High School vision of equity, said Thean Collins. She said this, quote, vision of equity was developed last school year, and is used in, quote, in all programs, all decisions, and all policies, unquote. It states, so when they're going to open it up with this vision of equity, I don't know if I said equality, I meant equity, this vision of equity, and here's what the vision of equity states, and this is how they open up all of their meetings, according to the principal. Quote, at Richfield High School, we believe in providing a rigorous and equitable education reflecting the strengths and experiences of our community. We believe students learn best when they feel safe and affirmed in who they are. Therefore, we commit to dismantling policies and processes that benefit whiteness and other systems of privilege. That's what they start out with every meeting. Kind of reminds me of, in the book Animal Farm, how they ended every meeting with the singing of Beasts of England, the propaganda song for the little communists. So, anyway, wouldn't you love to send your student to a school like that, where they are committed to dismantling policies and processes that benefit whiteness and other systems of privilege? And you can see Theon Collins on video making this statement at the link there in the outline. So I would say that critical race theory could be summarized by the following statement. All white people are racist. That's pretty much what it comes down to, if you really want to just break it down and make it simple. Now let's finally get to the Bible here, because that was a lot of reading, but I wanted, like I said, I wanted you to hear it out of the horse's mouth, because it's just that outrageous. Now there's only one race of human beings. So in a way, what they are saying, what the CRT people are saying, is there is an element of truth in that. There is only one race of human beings. They didn't really say that, but they said race is a social construct. Well, it depends on how you define race. If you define it as there are different races of people out there, then that is a social construct, because there aren't different races of people. There's one race. Race is a group of persons, animals, or plants connected by common descent or origin, the offspring or posterity of a person, a set of children or descendants. The Bible says in Acts 17 and verse 26, which is why I read that this morning, that God has made all people from one blood. Acts 17, 26, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation. So God has made all of us from one blood, from Adam and Eve. Therefore, there's only one race. It's called the human race. We're all made of one blood. We're not different types of people, right? We have variety among us, and we look a little different, right? But we're all one race. Now, variations in characteristics within the human family are a fact, not a social construct. So to look at different people and just say, oh, this is just a social construct. When you look at group A and say that they're just different in many ways than group B, that's just also, you know, you were just taught that stuff, right? There's no difference between any of these people. That's just ridiculous. Of course there's a difference. We look very different. We act differently. Go to a different culture. Even if they're the people of the same, I mean, go to a European culture or something. And we're all the same, right? We all came from the same people in Europe, and yet they have a different culture. They have different ways of going about things, right? I mean, we all act differently. We all look differently. And to point that out is not being a racist. It's just being a realist. The Bible points out the fact that Ethiopians have dark skin. Jeremiah 13 and verse 23. Jeremiah 13, 23. Can the Ethiopian change his skin? Or the leopard his spots? Then may ye also do good that are accustomed to doing or to do evil. So the Ethiopian clearly here is referring to a black man. Ethiopian, by definition, is a native of Ethiopia, a Negro, blackamoor. So, you know, obviously there are differences. If there was no difference between an Ethiopian and, you know, a Mediterranean, Middle Eastern person that was writing this verse, then there'd be no point in saying about an Ethiopian changing his skin, right? I mean, obviously he's got different skin or different color skin than other people do, right? That's nothing wrong with saying that. This is an immutable physical characteristic. It's not a social construct. Now, some cultures have gained a justified bad reputation based on observable bad behavior and character flaws. And I got an example of this in the Bible. Titus 1 and verse 12. Titus 1 and verse 12. Paul says, one of themselves, even a prophet of their own, said, the Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, slow bellies. Now, this is one of their own, right? This wasn't a foreigner saying this of them. It was a Cretan saying, you know what? I'm going to be honest about my own people here. Liars, evil beasts, and slow bellies, they're lazy. A bunch of lying, lazy, evil beasts. That's what their own prophet thought of them. Now, obviously, there had been that type of behavior had been pervasive enough in the Cretan culture that it was a stereotype of Cretans in general, okay? Now, stereotypes that arise about such cultures who exhibit immoral behavior are not the product of racism, but the product of observation. Was the guy that wrote this a racist? No, he's talking about his own people. Right? One of your own selves, one of your own prophets. He's not a racist. He's just pointing out that these people have stereotypically bad behavior. You're just observing something. It's also not wrong to affirm the truth of such stereotypes. Look at what Paul says in the next verse. He says, "This witness is true. Therefore, rebuke them sharply that they may be sound in the faith." Was Paul a racist against the Cretans? No. But Paul could look and say, "Yep, I've been around enough Cretans, and I have seen that they are liars, evil beasts, and slow bellies. It's true. Titus, you're their pastor, rebuke them, that they may be sound in the faith." There's nothing wrong with affirming a stereotype if it's generally true about a certain type of people. And I mean, there are people in various cultures that have stereotypes about them. And usually those things come about just because you just observe and you just see, you know, certain people act in certain ways. And so in that regard, there's nothing wrong with a stereotype. But it is wrong, however, to judge an individual based on a stereotype when that individual does not exhibit the stereotypical behavior, right? So it is not wrong for Paul to say, you know what, it's true that the Cretans are liars, evil beasts, and slow bellies. It would be wrong for Paul to meet a member of the Cretan church who's not a liar, evil beast, and slow belly and just say, yep, I know what you people are like, and I know what you're like. No, that's wrong. You don't apply the stereotype to an individual. You give the individual the benefit of the doubt until he shows himself to be, you know, guilty of that stereotype. It's just like Martin Luther King said. He had a dream that one day that his children would be judged by the content of their character and not the color of their skin. And that's exactly what it comes down to. People should be judged by the content of their character, not the color of their skin. It doesn't matter what color they are. It doesn't matter what nation they're from. It doesn't matter what ethnicity they are. Judge them by the content of their character. Racial divisions have no bearing on a person's relationship with God. See, the Bible is not a racist book. Salvation is by grace. It's not by race. When the church in Jerusalem had the council about whether the Gentiles needed to be circumcised and keep the law of Moses, Peter stood up and he talked about how God had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles through him, and that he had given the Gentiles the same gift of salvation as he had given to the Jews. And he said there in verse 11, Acts 15 and verse 11, "But we believe that through the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, we shall be saved even as they." Now, you want to talk about a group of people that had some racist tendencies. The Jews in that day did. They wouldn't eat with a person of another nation. They looked down on people of another nation. The Jews looked down on the Samaritans. They didn't want anything to do with the Samaritans, right? So this was a monumental thing, for one thing, for the Gentiles to be brought into the faith. But Peter recognizes here, they are saved by grace just like us. There's no difference. Yeah, they may look differently than us. They may speak a different language than us. They may have different manners and customs than us, right? But we're all saved by grace. God doesn't care about race, and neither should we. That's the thing. I don't care about race. The only reason I'm doing this sermon is because there are people out there trying to destroy this country by using race to do it. I could not care less about race. I don't make friendships based on race. I don't determine anything based on race. I don't care. Nobody should. Just judge people on the content of their character. In the Church of Jesus Christ, ethnicity or national identity is immaterial. Let's look at Colossians 3 and verse 11. Colossians 3 and verse 11. I'm just showing you here, the Bible is not a racist book. If there have been Christians in the past that were racist, and there were, there have been plenty of them, they did not get it from the Bible. They got it from somewhere else, but it did not come from the Bible. Colossians 3 and verse 11. Yeah, there were a lot of wrongs that happened in this country. All the Jim Crow laws, segregating people, not allowing black people to drink at the same water fountains, not allowing them to eat in the same restaurants, not making them sit in the back of the bus, all that stuff. There were horrible, terrible injustices that were done. And then there was a lot of progress made, like I said. And now they're trying to stoke up all the race wars again. Colossians 3 and verse 11. Where there is neither Greek nor Jew, circumcision nor uncircumcision, barbarian, Scythian, bond nor free, but Christ is all and in all. No racial distinctions. A barbarian is a foreigner, one whose language and customs differ from the speaker's. A Scythian is a person belonging to the race by which Scythia was inhabited, a Scyth. And Scythian, the adjective, is pertaining to Scythia, an ancient region extending over a large part of European and Asiatic Russia, or to the nomadic people by whom it was inhabited. So he's talking about people that would be from a totally different country. They would look different, right? They're probably white, actually. Scythians, if they were Russian from way up north, they were probably white, like Caucasian. And you know what the Bible's saying? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you're Jew, Greek, barbarian, Scythian, black, white, yellow, or red. It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. Nationality, ethnicity, race, or skin color matters not in Christ. The only thing that matters are these three things, the Bible says. First of all, that a man is a new creature in Christ through regeneration. Galatians 6 and verse 15. Galatians 6 and verse 15. It says, for in Christ Jesus neither circumcision availeth anything nor uncircumcision, but a new creature. That's the only thing that matters. Are you born again? Have you been given a new spirit within? Skin color is immaterial. The second thing is that he exercises faith that works by love. Look at Galatians 5 and verse 6. For in Christ Jesus neither circumcision availeth anything nor uncircumcision, but faith which worketh by love. He's saying whether you're a Jew or a Gentile, and a Gentile would be every other people on the face of the earth. Whether you're Jewish or African or European or Australian or Chinese or whatever, it doesn't matter. The only thing matters is faith that worketh by love. And that he keeps God's commandments. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 19. 1 Corinthians 7 and verse 19. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but the keeping of the commandments of God. That's what it comes down to. Let me give you another example, I'm going to give you a few more examples here, of how the Bible is not a racist book. The Ethiopian eunuch, you remember him from Acts chapter 8? He was treated no differently than any other man by Philip the Evangelist. I won't read the passage, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but in Acts chapter 8, 26 through 39, Philip comes across this Ethiopian eunuch coming back from Jerusalem, going back to Ethiopia, and the man's in a chariot and he's reading the book of Isaiah. And Philip comes up to him and he asks him if he understands what he reads. And he says, how can I except some man should guide me? And he asks him to come up into the chariot. Philip goes up, he gets in the chariot with him. He explains the gospel to him, he teaches him, and then they come to a water and he baptizes him. Ethiopian eunuch was a black guy. Philip was a Mediterranean, Middle Easterner, right? He didn't care. He treated him just like anybody else. And so should we. And then here's one. This is one of my favorites. In Acts 13 and verse 1, there was a guy in the church in Antioch who had a nickname named Niger. Acts 13 and verse 1. Now there were in the church that was at Antioch certain prophets and teachers, as Barnabas and Simeon, that is called Niger, and Lucius of Cyrene and Manaen, which had been brought up with Herod the Tetrarch, and Saul. This guy was a black guy. You know how I know that? Because of his name. It says there his name was Simeon, that was called Niger. Okay, so his real name was Simeon, but they basically gave him a nickname. They called him Niger. And this is really interesting. You know what Niger means? It means black. This is from Smith's Bible Dictionary. Niger, black. Niger is the additional or distinctive name given to the Simeon, who was one of the teachers and prophets in the church at Antioch. This is from Fawcett's Bible Dictionary. Niger, surname of Simeon, second of the five teachers and prophets of the Antioch church, Acts 13:1, means black, probably an African proselyte because he is associated with Lucius of Cyrene in Africa. His Hebrew name, Simeon, shows his Hebrew extraction. So they literally named this black man, they nicknamed him Black. I just think that's interesting. It'd be like if I was around with the apostles back then, they would have probably nicknamed me Whitey, right? Because you know, they were olive-skinned or whatever, and I'm very white and Caucasian, they'd probably nicknamed me Whitey, just like they nicknamed him Black. I just think it's so interesting. I mean, were they a bunch of racists? No, of course not. This destroys this whole idea. This is a side note, but this destroys the idea of the Black Hebrew Israelite doctrine. There's a doctrine out there, and there are people out there that believe it, that believe that the Jews were black, that Jesus was black, and that the real Hebrew people were black. And they're a bunch of racists themselves. I've seen a video of these guys at a rally in Washington, D.C. with that Nicholas Sandman. He was the guy that they said was supposedly making these racial slurs against that Indian guy. This is a few years ago at a pro-life rally in Washington, D.C. Turns out they slandered him. He didn't do a thing, and he ended up suing and winning against the major media companies for a lot of money. But anyway, there were these black Hebrew Israelites there, and they were hurling these insults at this Indian guy, calling him a Uncle Tomahawk and all kinds of stuff. It was, I mean, and saying horrible things about him. And of course, the Indian guy comes against these little white kids and tries to make it look like they were the ones that were trying to racially discriminate against him when it was the black Hebrew Israelites that were hurling all the horrible slanders. But anyway, these guys maintain, and there are a lot of people, there are people out there on the internet, that the Hebrews and the Jews and Jesus Christ were all black. Let me ask you a question. If these Jews here in Antioch, like Barnabas and Paul, right, if they were all black, why would they nickname a black guy Black? That make any sense? Of course not, right? You'd nickname a black guy Black because he's black, he's different than you are, right? Right? That's where nicknames come from, right? So that kind of just dismantles that whole idea. Niger, out of the Oxford English Dictionary, is Neger or Negro, meaning black, of course. And Negro, out of the Oxford English Dictionary, is an individual, especially a male, belonging to the African race of mankind, which is distinguished by a black skin, black, tightly curled hair, and a nose flatter and lips thicker and more protruding than is common amongst white Europeans. Now, if you just read that definition in society today, you'd probably be tarred and feathered and put in prison or something just for reading the definition of Negro out of the dictionary. But anyway, that's what the word means. Now notice in the church here in Antioch, Niger was not put in the back of the bus in the church, so to speak. He was rather a prophet and a teacher, and he was one of the men that ordained Paul and sent him off on his evangelistic trip. This was a major player in the church at Antioch. He's one of their ministers, a prophet of the Lord. You know, far from being discriminated against and persecuted and looked down upon, he's one of the major guys. He's the guy that lays hands on Paul and sends him off on his evangelistic missions. Think about that. You think they were racist against this man, Niger? Of course not. They didn't care that he was black. Didn't matter one bit to them. Look at verse 2, Acts 13 and verse 2. And as they ministered to the Lord and fasted, the Holy Ghost said, "Separate me, Barnabas and Saul, for the work whereunto I have called unto them." And when they had fasted and prayed, they laid their hands on them and sent them away. They, that is, Niger being one of them. Can you imagine being one of the men that ordained the Apostle Paul to go out and convert the entire world and turn the world upside down? This was Niger, the guy that was nicknamed Black. I think that's pretty cool. And then you have the example of the other Ethiopian eunuch in the Bible. This was a good man who was used by God to save the prophet Jeremiah. I'm not going to read it in the interest of time. I've already been going for a long time. You can read about this in Jeremiah 38, 7 through 13. This is when Jeremiah was thrown in the well, and he's down there in the mire. And the guy's name was Ebed-Melech, an Ethiopian. And he had compassion on Jeremiah. He went to the king and said, Jeremiah's going to starve to death down there. And the king sent him, I think it was 30 men, and they went and they took cords and they took old cloths and lowered him down in there and drew Jeremiah up out of that well. So it was because of this black man that Jeremiah was saved alive. So like I said, the Bible is not racist against blacks or any other culture for that matter at all. The Christianity knows nothing of racism. And furthermore, and I'm just going to make reference to this stuff because I do want to get through this section. The Bible does not forbid interracial marriage either. Now, the Old Testament forbade the Jews from marrying the Canaanites, but not because of their race, because of their wicked religion and their moral depravity. And you can read about that in Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 5, and Leviticus 18, 27 through 28. So it had nothing to do with the race of the people. It was their religion. That's why they were forbidden from marrying them. And then we have the example of Moses, who married an Ethiopian woman, a black woman. Moses was not black, right? Moses was Middle Eastern, olive-skinned probably. And he marries this black woman, and his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam took issue with him because he married an Ethiopian woman. You read in Numbers 12 and verse 1. They questioned Moses' authority as a man of God because of this interracial marriage, so to speak. They really stepped over the line on this one. And the Lord was angry with them, and he chided them for speaking against Moses in Numbers 12:3-9. So angry was the Lord at Miriam for being mad at Moses for marrying a black woman that the Lord made her leprous, white as snow. You read about that in Numbers 12 and verse 10. Now, I just have to wonder, and I've wondered this for a long time, if when the Lord made her, quote, white as snow, unquote, if this wasn't an ironic judgment because she thought lighter-skinned people were superior to darker-skinned people. He says, all right, Miriam, you think lighter-skinned people are superior and Moses really messed up by marrying a black woman? You think white people are so great? I'm going to make you as white as snow. I'm going to make you whiter than any white person in this world. But regardless of why, this was a severe punishment. The Lord was not happy with her speaking against Moses for marrying a black woman. And Moses was better than his siblings, and he besought the Lord to heal Miriam, and he did. He made her be leprous for a week and then took it away from her. So the Bible nowhere forbids two people of different ethnicities or skin colors from marrying each other only for those reasons alone. Okay? Now, of course, you might be forbidden from marrying somebody of a different skin color if, for instance, that person's already married, right? The Lord might say, nope, you can't marry that black woman. Why not, Lord? Because she's married to somebody else, right? Right. So there might be other reasons, right? And it may not be wise to marry somebody of a different, to marry somebody, period, of a different religion that's, you know, especially some evil religion or something like that. But we're not forbidden to marry somebody of a different skin color just because of their skin color. I mean, I'm married to a woman of color, am I not? Right? Anybody that's not white is a person of color, right? So I'm married to a woman of color. Obviously, I've got no problem with it. So anyway, next time we'll pick it up, and I'm going to start talking about discrimination, and we're going to talk about other things like reparations, and it should be some interesting stuff, I think. And it's going to be a lot more Bible next time than it was this time. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention this morning.
Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.